and it's going to be very expensive. It's what I call a survey debt that's being passed on.
A new surveying requirement for federal land transfers is drawing criticism from the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 19th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, the state's revenue predictions are out, including how much it could make from oil taxes.
Is every dollar in the price of oil is worth about $30 million?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Alaska's three Electoral College members have cast their ballots for Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Tradition and state law dictate that all three of Alaska's electors vote for Trump, though the U.S. Constitution does not bind them. One of the electors, Jacqueline Tupo of Juneau, has been especially vocal about wrestling with her role. She spoke with Pat Race in last week's Hello Alaska podcast.
I've probably had at least 600 contacts from people.
Wow.
So my mailbox literally broke between all the letters in it and the heavy snow that we've had here in Juneau. Also on Facebook, people contact me. I've had a couple hundred messages there. And I've also been contacted on my personal email.
The mail and other contacts did not sway her. Tupo voted for Trump. A joint session of Congress is expected to formally count all the Electoral College votes on January 5th. At statehood, Alaska was promised more than 100 million acres of land. So far, the federal government has transferred just 65% of that. That's because it takes time to survey the land. And at the current pace, it'll take another 20 years. Today, the Federal Bureau of Land Management announced it's imposing a new surveying method to speed things up. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the state is not happy about it.
The current method for surveying is hard work, and it's expensive. Surveyors have to fly into remote areas, run chainsaws through brush, and place brass markers, called monuments, at two-mile intervals. The new method is based on GPS coordinates. BLM Director Neil Cornsey says it requires far fewer monuments in the field and would save about $60 million.
And we've found by applying GPS technology, the same type of technology that drives your smartphone, we can cut the time in half, we can cut cost in half, and Alaskans can have the land that's due to them.
But this method, known as direct point position survey, is controversial. The state has been fighting it for years. Alaska Commissioner of Natural Resources Andy Mack says the federal government is violating an agreement to give the state land that's been properly surveyed.
The problem is that the methodology which has been proposed by the BLM is untested, and we're not so sure that this isn't simply passing on the costs that by agreement the federal government has agreed to pick up, that we're not so sure that those won't be passed on to the state.
Without the monuments in the ground, Mac says it's not clear anyone who buys land from the state could record their purchase. Steve Buchanan is a surveyor and past president of the Alaska Society of Professional Land Surveyors. He says those brass markers are the best evidence to show where a landowner's property lines are.
When someone goes out and they want to look and see where their land is, they look for monuments. They find those monuments, they can see it, they can touch it, they know where their land is.
With the DPPS system, Buchanan says, there might not be a monument for many miles, so a landowner would have to pay to put them in.
And it's going to be very expensive. It's what I call a survey debt that's being passed on from the BLM to the state, and then it could be passed from the state to whoever buys that land.
Cornsey, the BLM director, says the new GPS method will be a legally valid way to establish the state's property lines. He says eventually the BLM will use it in other states, too. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
When it comes to the state's bottom line, the tax division's revenue sources book predicts a patchwork of good and bad news for the state. The good? Oil prices are forecasted to go up. The bad? The money coming in from oil revenue is nowhere near enough to close the state's budget gap, and production on the North Slope is forecasted to go down. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more.
Have a lawmaker, the governor, or maybe someone in Alaska's oil and gas industry on your holiday gift list this year? They'd probably love a good crystal ball, one that might give them a glimpse of the future price of oil, or how much the state's going to produce next year, and maybe a look at the end of the legislative session to find out what's going to happen with all of those tax proposals floating around. Unfortunately, no such soothsayer exists, and they'll probably have to rely on the state's Department of Revenue. Earlier this week, analysts released their semi-annual revenue sources book. It's a snapshot of the state's financial health. It has current and historical income information. And for the analyst on your list, it also has predictions of the price of oil for the next few years and how much the state's going to produce and what kind of money the state expects to have available to spend. And this year, a whole chapter on the potential impacts of an income or sales tax. And while it's no crystal ball, it can help with the economic forecast. First, the good news. Oil prices are predicted to go up. During this fiscal year, they'll average $46.81 a barrel, and that's expected to go up to $54 per barrel next year. State Tax Division Director Ken Alper says the price jump is going to help the state.
A good rule of thumb for Alaska at the range of prices we're at right now is every dollar in the price of oil is worth about $30 million.
So a $10 jump in the price of oil means that over the course of the next year, the state should get about $300 million in additional revenue. But that's not nearly enough to cover the state's $3 billion budget deficit.
It's substantial. No one should ever scoff at $300 million, but that's not balancing the budget.
One other consequence of that slight jump in oil prices, the state's going from a price that's below the oil industry's break-even point to above it. That price is around $45 a barrel. And that break-even point is very important for the state. When oil prices fall below it, the major producers on the North Slope start losing money. And they can turn those operating losses into credits that can be used to offset taxes they owe to the state. They're still required to pay a minimum tax, but then if it carries into the next year, the companies are able to use those credits to offset even that minimum tax.
So we were seeing production tax revenues approaching zero for the next several years because of the very low prices we were seeing now.
So as oil prices inch upward, the state's revenue picture starts to look a little better.
That phenomenon falls off a little bit, and we now are starting to see a couple hundred million dollars in production tax revenues in the near future. Not the billions that we had in the past when prices were higher, but at least not zero.
Now, the bad news. There are still significant challenges ahead for the state. Oil production is forecasted to go down, prices aren't forecasted to get above $88 a barrel in the next decade, and the legislature is gearing up for a fight over oil tax credits, broad-based taxes, and just how to solve the state's budget crisis. And no amount of prognosticating can tell how policymakers will resolve those arguments. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, more than a year after President Obama brought worldwide attention to Alaska's Arctic villages, has anything changed?
We don't call them climate change adaptation plans. We call them a survival plan.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
More Alaskans killed themselves in 2015 than in any previous year since at least 1978. 200 people died by suicide in the state, 28 more than the previous record set in 2013. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the state's response to the increase.
Experts say it's difficult to determine the causes for the high number of suicides. Kate Burkhart is the executive director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. She says inconsistent access to behavioral health care contributes to the state's high suicide level.
We have very high incidences of adverse childhood experiences, interpersonal violence and domestic violence, substance abuse, and depression and other mental health disorders. And so we have that constellation of risk factors present pretty much throughout the state. Access to health care, though, is not consistent throughout the state.
Burkhart says one factor that may have increased the number of suicides in 2015 was two events that gained a high profile: a cluster of suicides in the southwest Alaska village of Hooper Bay and a suicide at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention may have prompted other deaths.
Suicides that receive a great deal of coverage in the media, for someone who's already at risk, it can increase that risk.
The Suicide Prevention Council worked with AFN on prevention programs at this year's convention. The suicide total includes 67 deaths of Alaska Natives. Among Alaska Native men, the age-adjusted rate was 80 suicides per 100,000, more than six times the rate for all American adults. Barbara Franks is a board member of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Her son Ron died by suicide in 1997 when he was 23. Franks, who is Tlingit, says focusing on ethnicity can detract from understanding the individual causes of suicide.
I stop the categorizing when they say a young male from Alaska. You get to find that people will become more sensitive of how they're categorized than to find out why or what happened.
Frank says the downturn in the state's economy likely contributed to the high number of suicides last year. It's too early to say whether the number has dropped this year, since 2016 statistics aren't compiled until next year. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, schools, and other suicide prevention programs receive a little more than $1.5 million annually from the state. Burkhart says it's difficult to compare the 2015 suicide total to past data. That's because the stigma surrounding suicide discouraged reporting, and that stigma has lessened over time.
As we get better and better at tracking the data, and as people are less reluctant to say, yes, my loved one died by suicide, we are going to see an increase in the numbers. It happens with other things like domestic violence and other issues where stigma has prevented a good picture being painted.
Public health experts say that if people notice warning signs of suicidal behavior, such as talking about it or ways to do it, they should seek advice on treatment. The volume of calls to the state suicide prevention care line has increased more than 60% in the past 2 years. Governor Bill Walker's new budget proposal increases funding for programs that include suicide prevention. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaskans can get more support at carelinealaska.com or by calling 1-877-266-4357. A 27-year-old man has been sentenced to 6 months in prison after pleading guilty to charges connected with a snow machine attack on two mushers who were competing in the Iditarod last winter. The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports Arnold Damoski of Nulato had already served most of his sentence while awaiting the judge's decision. Damoski pleaded guilty to felony criminal mischief and misdemeanor charges of assault, reckless endangerment, and driving under the influence. He drove a snow machine at four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King, as well as at Ali Zirkle on March 12th near Nulato. One of King's dogs was killed and others were injured. It's been more than a year since President Barack Obama visited Alaska and became the first sitting president to travel above the Arctic Circle. The trip was designed to draw attention to climate change in the lead up to last year's international conference in Paris. And the president went out of his way to highlight Alaska villages threatened by rapid erosion. But as Obama prepares to leave office, most of those villages find themselves no closer to a solution. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
On September 2nd, 2015, President Obama stepped up to the microphone in the Kotzebue School gym.
Hello, Alaska! Hello, Kotzebue!
Obama said he had come north for one big reason: to raise the alarm about the danger of climate change from some of the places where it's most obvious. Places like the eroding village of Kivalina, which he flew over on his way to Kotzebue. For many Alaskans, he said, it's no longer a question of if they will have to relocate, but when. If a foreign power threatened to wipe an American community off the map, he said, the federal government would do everything in its power to stop it. Climate change should be no different.
And what's happening here is America's wake-up call. It should be the world's wake-up call.
I appreciated that he said that, but I haven't personally, I haven't really seen anything come out of it.
Maya Lukin was mayor of Kotzebue during the president's visit. She also worked on climate change issues for the Manilek Association, the regional nonprofit. Lukin was pretty excited about Obama's visit.
You know, personally, I was like, I'm going to meet the president.
And professionally, she hoped his visit would draw attention to the issues facing rural Alaska, which it did. And she appreciates that. But she says attention isn't enough.
When the president says something like the United States would do anything in its power to make sure that these places aren't wiped off the face of the earth, you got to put your money where your mouth is.
And on that front, the response hasn't matched the rhetoric. 5 months after the president's visit, the Obama administration released its major funding proposal as part of its final budget request to Congress. $400 million over 10 years for issues including village relocation in rural Alaska. But Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski called that basically a bait and switch. The program would have been paid for by taking revenue away from other oil-producing states, and it had little chance of passing Congress. Murkowski accused the Obama administration of using Alaska as just a backdrop for his climate change agenda. During his visit to Kotzebue, Obama also announced that the Denali Commission, which has historically built infrastructure in rural Alaska, would be the lead federal agency coordinating relocation efforts.
There would be one federal agency that could marshal all the federal agencies together and then be responsive to the state and the individual communities.
Joel Niemeyer is co-chair of the Denali Commission. He says that's a pretty big deal. But the new assignment came with no new funding. The Obama administration requested an additional $4 million a year for the commission, but Congress has yet to appropriate it. Niemeyer says the Denali Commission is doing what it can within its small existing budget. But it's frustrating.
All of Alaska now knows the commission has this assignment. My concern is that if in future appropriations there are no funds for this effort, that's the material to rural Alaska. They're still going to come to us and say, this is your assignment. See it through.
And Niemeyer says for a while this year, he even had trouble getting a call back from the White House to clarify his agency's new assignment. Obama, of course, has many fans in rural Alaska, and they point out there's only so much the president can do. It's Congress that controls the federal purse strings. And Sally Russell Cox, a planner with the state who's worked on relocation for about a decade, says the issues are clearly getting more attention.
The federal agencies are now engaged at a very high level, so there's a lot of high-level attention to how funding and other resources can be pooled to help these communities.
Agencies, including the Departments of Agriculture, Energy, and Interior, have made money available for things like water infrastructure, energy efficiency, and planning, but nothing close to the amounts needed to move a whole village. Cox says the state will continue to do what it can, but she says the federal government has a special responsibility, because in many cases, villages are where they are because the federal government put them there, often by choosing the location for a school. With Obama on his way out the door, that federal responsibility now falls to Congress and the incoming Trump administration. Maya Lukin in Kotzebue says she hopes the next president will pay attention because rural Alaska is running out of time.
We don't call them climate change adaptation plans. We call them a survival plan. So how are we going to survive? How are we going to ensure that our culture stays alive in, you know, our changing weather?
For now, that's a question without a good answer. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
The Obama administration did have one pot of money it could have used to help villages dealing with climate change, but none of that money came to Alaska. Tomorrow, we'll hear why.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. and it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
An Aleutic Language Immersion Preschool will open in Kodiak next month. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has the story.
Teacher Michael Bach says he and his colleagues will lead classes all in Aleutic, and it'll be much like any other preschool.
You know, preschoolers don't really learn about English. Like, a preschooler doesn't walk into preschool and teachers say, you know, this is a preposition and this is a verbal phrase. We won't be doing that. We'll just be playing, essentially, in Aleutic. So instead of having story time in English, they're going to be having story time in Aleutic. Instead of teachers having snack time in English, we're going to be doing it in Aleutic.
He says the Language Nest is part of a larger project through the Shunack Tribe of Kodiak that reaches out to communities and schools to encourage Aleutic language learning. It's an initiative which received a $2 million grant this year from the Administration for Native Americans. That funding, to be distributed over 5 years, has allowed the preschool to offer a $50 entry fee per semester. Bach says the program will encourage active family involvement, and staff would ask parents to attend community language events.
So that the burden of language learning isn't on your little one alone, but you would be learning alongside them. And at those events, we'll be giving adults, siblings, aunts and uncles, whoever is interested, access to some of the language that their kids are learning, or their nieces or nephews, or their little brothers or sisters are learning at the Language Nest.
He says elders will play a role in helping the teachers sustain complete language immersion.
Myself and Maria, we weren't raised speaking Aleutic. It's not our first language, so it's a lot of work to stay in the language. And having fluent speakers there to support us will make sure that snack time, play time, story time, circle time will all be done in Aleutic.
The preschool's first day will be in late January. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
In the past 2 months, 300 dead puffins have washed up on St. Paul Island, alarming residents who had only seen 6 carcasses over the last decade. Now, the die-off appears to be slowing down. But as Laura Craigle of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, scientists say it could be a sign of a much larger ecosystem problem.
Lauren Devine didn't panic when St. Paul residents found a few dead puffins on the beach in mid-October.
The first day was a tufted puffin, the next day was a horned puffin. I didn't think too much about it.
Devine is co-director of St. Paul's Ecosystem Conservation Office. She says within the week, it became clear something was wrong, as islanders found more and more carcasses. They posted photos on Facebook and called the eco office concerned. Devine took the first dead birds to Anchorage for research, while her co-director hopped on a four-wheeler and hit the beaches to gauge the extent of the problem.
She called me up and said, you know, I followed up on these citizen reports of puffins, and they're everywhere. There's dead puffins everywhere.
The carcasses came ashore in waves, dozens at a time. They washed up so fast, most were still intact days later, a sign there were so many scavenging foxes couldn't keep up. Devine says the extent of the die-off was frightening. St. Paul residents began patrolling the beaches daily, and the eco office had 10 dead puffins necropsied.
After we opened up the first 5, it was very apparent that all of them were emaciated. Their muscles were completely atrophied. They had empty stomachs. They had gastrointestinal bleeding, which really indicates severe long-term starvation. So they were just in very, very poor shape.
The theory, Devine says, is that the puffins left the island and headed south to winter in the Bering Sea as usual. But when they couldn't find food, they grew weak, starved, and were carried back to St. Paul by ocean currents.
So we started digging into this more and thinking, well, you know, what is happening? Where is their food?
To answer those questions, the Eco Office enlisted help from the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, based at the University of Washington. COAST is a citizen science program that has 800 volunteers collecting data on seabirds, from Northern California all the way to Kotzebue and Cape Lisburn. Julia Parrish is executive director of the program. She says all that local data helps piece together the big picture unfolding across the North Pacific Ocean, as well as the Bering and Chukchi Seas. Right now, the major force at work is a big patch of warm water called the blob. Parrish says it's affecting the entire marine ecosystem.
Suddenly, the grocery store is full of new things and less good things to eat.
The changes begin at the bottom of the food chain, with plankton and forage fish, the kind of fish that make up a puffin's diet. Those small fish try to adjust to the warmth, swimming to different areas or diving deeper in search of cool water. For the puffins on St. Paul, that's meant widespread starvation. In fact, Parrish says the 300 birds found dead may represent just 10% of the total die-off, when you account for carcasses that are probably blowing past the small island.
That would mean those 300 birds scale up to 3,000 birds, and 3,000 birds is half of the breeding population of the Pribilof Islands.
The people of St. Paul don't harvest puffins for subsistence, but Parrish says seabirds are good indicators of overall ecosystem health. That means this die-off could be a sign of trouble for all sorts of species that residents rely on to fill their freezers.
Can these populations sustain this kind of long-term change pressure? Boy, that's a great question, and I wish I knew the answer to that. I can tell you, I think it's going to be stressful for them for a while.
Back in St. Paul, Lauren Devine says it looks like the puffin die-off is slowing down, but the Eco Office is also seeing signs of stress in other species. She says the island's seabirds laid barely any eggs this season. Hunters had a hard time finding sea lions, and crab quotas were cut sharply after a survey showed low numbers.
It is all interrelated, from the smallest harmful algal blooms and phytoplankton issues to whale die-offs, loss of sea ice. It's absolutely all connected, and I think that we're so far past the point of needing some kind of conservation and management actions before it's too late, you know, to give the ecosystem a fighting chance.
But even for scientists, it's hard to know what to do. As Parrish says, you can't legislate water temperature. So for now, that leaves the people of St. Paul to pick up dead birds from their beaches as they monitor the changing ocean that surrounds them. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Laura Craigle in Unalaska.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jeremy Shea, Rasha McChesney, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hellman. Have a nice night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.